Representative Butler, who is here on, is it 279? Senate Bill 279? Then that's the one we will open with. Open a work session, I'm sorry, a public hearing on House Senate Bill 279. And welcome Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Butler. I'm House District 60 State Representative. I don't have to give you a speech about House District 60. Everyone here, I know by look of your face, knows where House District 60 is, knows where the beautiful part of Oregon starts and where Oregon starts its day, depending upon how we vote on that.
Excuse me, that's my district, the beautiful part.
No, it's a different time zone we're talking
about. That's true.
Where people ride off into the sunset, too.
An hour earlier than the rest of us.
You bet.
You absolutely open the door.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee, I come today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 279. It's with a great deal of reservation that I'm even discussing issues relative to the Board of Tax Service Examiners and the Board of Tax Practitioners, as they may eventually be called. My first exposure to the, let me back up and just say for the record that I am a certified public accountant, and I do income tax work in my professional life when I used to have a professional life. But I also want to say that I have members of my staff, or my former staff that I've, of the firm that I work with, that are licensed tax preparers and licensed tax consultants, subject to the licensure of this board. Their ability, this board's ability, to increase or decrease their fees on them, my employees or former employees, would have some financial and fiscal effect to those folks, but they are no longer my current employees. So I don't know that this has any particular fiscal effect on me in one way or the other. My first exposure to the actual board itself was 2 years ago, when in general government, Subcommittee on Ways and Means, we heard the fees bill for the Board of Tax Service Examiners for the state of Oregon. It was a rather curt and contentious meeting. We did go ahead and pass out a bill to go ahead and proceed to allow the Board of Tax Service Examiners to proceed. Several questions were asked at that time. We did not include any budget notes because they assured us that things would be fine, that things would be back up to speed very shortly, and they, as my recollection is, that they had some interim management at that particular time, but that they were doing fine. You will today likely hear from the folks from the Board of Tax Service Examiners. You'll hear that Oregon is very well protected as a result of having a Board of Tax Service Examiners. I need to let you know that I do have a House bill, which I'm having the staff bring down to me right now, which does away with the Board of Tax Service Examiners, which came out as a result of, the fact that when we did hear the Board of Tax Service Examiners in our last session, that there didn't appear to be a great need. As a matter of fact, as we visited with the professionals, the tax professionals, who do a lot of the tax crunching and grinding in this state, there was not a great fondness nor a great desire to have these folks continue, that their work was not necessarily that above a cut above anyone else. At that time, I believe the testimony reflected that Oregon was the one of all 50 states, the only one of all 50 states, which had such a board, that is an interior licensing board for tax practitioners. I understand now that California has adopted a modified tax service license board for tax preparers and tax practitioners within the state of California. Otherwise, the folks that can prepare income tax returns are those folks who hang up a shingle and say, we prepare tax returns, or taxes done cheap here, or something of that nature, and it's buyer beware. Now, that having been said, I need to let you know that I've been barraged as a result of my introduction of House Bill 3526, which does away with the Board of Tax Service Examiners and would obliterate it. It would be the first time in over 20 years, I think, that this body would have done away with a board, and this board has been around for nearly a quarter of a century. It was incepted back about a quarter of a century ago at the height of a time when tax shelters were being marketed fairly aggressively throughout the United States. And I want you to know that the Internal Revenue Service has a pretty good hand on that now, and the long arm of the IRS is what puts most folks, including Al Capone, behind bars. And so that's where we get the major portion of the protection that's afforded the local citizenry of the state of Oregon. That having been said, you will probably hear testimony that the board is doing an excellent job of finding people who are preparing tax returns without licenses. And folks can do that in 48 of the 40 of the 50 states right now. And when they happen to move to Oregon, they have to be licensed in order to prepare tax returns. Again, 2 years ago, we didn't have testimony that indicated that we were any better off as a result of licensing these folks. And the licensure, incidentally, costs taxpayers in this state, by passing these fees through to the taxpayers, and those folks who are having their income taxes prepared by a tax preparer, a licensed tax preparer, cost these folks around $900,000 per biennium. Now, we're going to be hearing the board of the licensure for the CPAs very shortly, and that'll be $1.5 million for over 5,000 licenses that are extended. And we have here a group of folks that are preparing tax returns who have a fee at $900,000 per biennium, and that's a lot when you compare it with folks that are involved in all of the municipal audits and those other kinds of things throughout the state of Oregon. Finally, let me say this. This year, so that there would be no question after the board left the Ways and Means process, this year we left with absolutely specific instructions in the form of a budget note. And the budget note has five bullets on it that basically says, if you can't prove the worth of your existence by the next time you folks come before us, then there's probably no reason why we should be passing on an other fees kind of an income approach to fund this particular group of folks for $900,000 on a biennial basis. And perhaps the director of the Board of Tax Service Examiners would speak to the budget note. I don't need to, but I do want to leave you with the absolute impression. I'm not sure how this Senate Bill 279 got through the Senate, but it will be one of the very few agencies within this state, including the CPAs, that do not have their own ability to set their own fees without legislative oversight. And with the kind of history that we've had with non-responsive boards in the past and non-responsive answers to questions relative to what happens and how taxpayers are actually protected by these folks, I would urge an absolute no vote if you get an opportunity to ever vote on Senate Bill 279. Thank you. Is there any question how I might feel about this?
No, I think we're all catching our breath. This passes for passion in this committee.
You mentioned the Board of Accountancy budget. What are these folks? When's the Board of Tax Examiners coming up in Ways and Means?
They have already come up in Ways and Means, Mr. Chair. These folks' budget has already come up in Ways and Means. It has passed Ways and Means with some rather restrictive language on it. They assured us that they are very much appreciated, so their budget has passed.
Okay, and that's the 2000. These are the budget notes attached to the 2003.
The 2001, 2003 budget. Yes, sir.
And has it come to the floor? The budget?
I don't know whether it's come to the floor yet or not. I don't know that it has.
Okay. Any other Representative Bates?
A couple of quick questions. I would hope that in the future you can tell us how you feel about things. Okay, so please speak up. Having sat in Ways and Means for a total of 8 weeks now and becoming an expert on it, not. We've passed out several budgets on other eight, with other funds involved, and I can share your concern that I get the impression sometimes from these groups that the only real leverage we have to work with them is on overseeing their budgets. I mean, the other choice is to dissolve them, I suppose. And is it your impression that they, groups like this, will respond to suggestions from the legislature if you keep control of their budgets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that's an excellent question. The power of the purse cannot be underestimated at any time, particularly if you can keep that power of the purse amongst a group of people who will think with clear and open minds relative to the issues involved. Unfortunately, there's always seems to be enough pressure, and I don't know how many emails anyone else has been receiving relative to 3526, House Bill 3526, but I want you to know that my system has been down for the last 2 days as a result of blockage, as a result of some of the emails that I've been getting. Now, some of those may deal with PUC or other issues, but I'm not quite sure about that. But and I expect my electricity and telephone to go out almost any time now. But in all seriousness, the issue of controlling the amount of the fee that's charged really is the compelling factor to Representative Bates' question, and that is, if the fee can have absolute fiscal oversight on the part of the legislators themselves, then you can hear from your constituents that are both in favor of or opposed to the fee increases. What Senate Bill 279 does, on the contrary, is it removes from the legislature that oversight and only leaves the issue of controlling the purse at the Ways and Means process, unless, of course, you wanted to do away with the actual institution itself.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, you're back.
Mr. Chair, may I just say one more thing?
Sure can.
If Senate Bill 279 does go ahead and is passed by the House, I intend to vigorously pursue a liquidation of this board. I think because of the history of problems and because of the concerns that have been expressed, I would vigorously pursue the removal of the board as a licensed state board, so that we can move back with the other 49 states or 48 states that basically depend upon the Internal Revenue Service to assist us with that level of competence and oversight.
Mm-hmm. Gordon, you have a question?
Yeah, I have one quick question. Feeling the level of your passion on this issue, I guess I'm just somewhat surprised at how it passed out of the Senate. Weren't some of the senators on the same Ways and Means sub that you were on last session, and did they not have similar issues or with the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tafori, my recollection is that I had two senators that served in that particular Ways and Means process, and one of those senators was largely absent, and the other one is no longer, Senator Lynn is no longer with us. So. In the legislative process, so I'm not certain as to why, if this was discussed in the Senate subcommittees, why this issue didn't come up, or why perhaps the senator who served on our Ways and Means Committee, it just never came to that particular senator's attention.
Actually, that raises one question. I guess we see the budget notes, obviously there must have been some substantial discussion about the board in the Ways and Means process. Did you propose eliminating the board or zeroing out their limitation even in Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, that's a very fair question. I was in Mexico at the time this board actually was making its presentation.
Sorry. Yeah, that was coming.
No, but the governor was. I was acting as an interpreter for the governor, as a matter of fact. No, at the time that this was actually heard before the board, I had asked that they please hold it up, and because I knew that they were going to be hearing this particular issue, and I asked that they please hold it up because I was very concerned about the issues that had not been answered, and I was already sitting on over the entire interim a draft relative to whether or not we should go ahead and do away with this board. When I returned and we went ahead and passed this out of committee, that's when we attached the budget notes that we have here today, and that's when some rather serious contemplation reflection came up over the issues, and we went ahead and passed that budget out based upon the fact that we have new board members and a new director, and we're told that one state, California, after a quarter of a century, has gone ahead and adopted some provisions of some consumer protection relative to tax preparers. And bottom line relative to this kind of issue is this. In Ontario, Oregon, we have an H&R Block. And across the river, we have an H&R Block in the state of Idaho. To get the same income tax return prepared in one versus the other, it's cheaper to go to Idaho. And the reason that it's cheaper to go to Idaho is that they don't have a licensure issue. Now, I get the same folks preparing the return at a cheaper price, and it drives business out of the state of Oregon. Now, again, some of the things that you'll hear, and you need to ask relative to what a good job these folks are doing, as to how many of these folks would be doing these things in other states anyway. I've got a list, I think, of about 15 items here that of actions the board has taken. Now, some of them may be for failure to have a license in the state of Oregon, therefore we're going to nail you for the 4,000 tax returns that you've prepared because you've let your license lapse in the state of Oregon. Well, I don't know that taxpayers are necessarily damaged as a result of the fact that somebody prepared a tax return without a license. You know, folks do it all the time in 48 other states, and the Internal Revenue Service doesn't seem to have a great deal of angst over that. Now, certainly, if the Internal Revenue Service had their way, they would encourage continuing professional education and encourage you to get an EA, an enrolled agent's license, which is sponsored by the Internal Revenue Service, and which you maintain through a degree of competency and examination. And that was one of the other concerns that we had with the board, and that's, you'll see as the final budget note, is that you've got grandfather practicing rights here. And that is, folks who have never passed any examination are still preparing tax returns under this particular program. And that creates a great deal of concern on my part and on the part of the professionals that these folks do not have, those folks that were practicing at the inception of these licenses didn't have to pass any kind of a, didn't have to sit for an exam. The professionals that serve on my Ways and Means, or the Ways and Means Committee that passed this out in general government this time, express real concern over that the public is not well served by giving grandfather licenses to folks who have been around for some time. Now, I will say this. About 80 years ago, 75 years ago, the CPA Society did, the American Institute of CPA Society did exactly that. They allowed everyone who was then practicing accounting that had graduated from a known school at that time, a university or a grad that were actually college graduates in accounting and business, they granted them certificates without examination. So that issue has happened even within my own profession, that about 70 years ago they did grant licenses without examination. Since that time, the CPA exam, and you'll see when you hear that the CPA, the State Board of Accountancy, their actual budget, you'll see that their budget is up by over 9% as a result of just the CPA examination costs as the CPA exam is administered as a uniform worldwide examination. And that's a real concern to the folks, and that was expressed when I returned from my sojourn not at public expense out of the state and out of my district.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Members of the Committee. Thank you.
Well, while we're in the hearing on this, why don't we go ahead and just finish this off? I probably should have paused for a second. We know what this bill does, I guess. Do you want to give us any further background than what we have?
Well, Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add is really the debate and the issues that Representative Butler raised today were not discussed in the Senate side. The Senate issue is largely the regulatory role of the board, and they did pass the measure without a nay vote, and it passed on the floor 27-1. So these are relatively new items that the Representative Butler has brought forward, at least in terms of the Senate debate.
Okay. Let's bring up, let's bring up Pamela Constantopoulos and Gerald Zielinski. Good afternoon.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, it is with great concern that I hear from Representative Butler. Of course, we are concerned with his issues. We are working with him to solidify those.
If you could state your name for the record.
Sorry. My name for the record is Pamela Constantopoulos. I am the director of the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. Our board licenses those people who prepare, assist, or advise in personal income tax matters for another person and for some sort of valuable consideration. At this time, we license approximately 2,200 licensed tax consultants and 1,700 licensed tax preparers, which is basically an apprenticeship level. Out of that 3,900 licensees, there are only 184 people who are grandfathered. That's only approximately 5%. And those were people who, at the inception of this law in 1974, were granted the right to practice. This bill affects only the fees of a group of licensed professionals. No fees for the general population are affected, and the fees for the highest of our licensees is $65. It's a very reasonable fee. And we are looking in rule to raise that to $75, a very negligible impact. Ways and Means knew of this bill, and they also knew of the proposed increase, which I have just stated to you. I have some testimony that I'll pass on to you. Senate Bill 279 is critical to the effectiveness of the board. At present, the fees are set in statute, and the legislature must act to address any funding problems that the board may encounter. This biennium, the board found itself in a very difficult financial situation, resulting primarily from lower revenues than what was anticipated in the budget that was developed. At the low point each year, the board has a negative balance at this present time. We have been doing everything in our power to severely reduce our expenditures. At times, it has been reduced as much as 36% in order to maintain our solvency. We have also sought to optimize any revenues that are out there. For instance, fines that have been hanging out there for as long as 10 years, we have been working actively to collect, and we are in the process of collecting them now. However, because the fees were determined in statute, we were powerless to do more to address the problem. This situation made it difficult for us to adequately fund portions of our operations, such as consumer awareness outreach. We have relied basically on the graciousness of the media to provide us with free airtime on television stations throughout the state, as well as newspaper publications to run articles and run, for instance, the violations that we've seen. The board's financial situation is critical, and without some action on the part of the legislature, the board will not be able to fulfill its statutory mission and continue protecting the consumer. And in our minds, it is the consumer which is foremost. It is not a group of professionals. Senate Bill 279 brings the Board of Tax Service Examiners in line with other boards. Last session, as many of you know, many of the boards moved to an independent status where they approve their own budgets and fees without going through the legislative process at all. Other boards, such as the Board of Accountancy, removed fees from statute, as we are requesting to do. We are requesting to bring our law in line with other boards who have removed their fees from statute, with the one exception is that we will still be subject to the Ways and Means process. If we come up with a too large an ending balance, we have to reduce fees. It's just the state standard, and we will be demanded to do so by Ways and Means. Senate Bill 279 is not a request to have free licensure to set our fees without control. Under the current law, any fee increase or establishment that occurs in rule will be reviewed by the Department of Administrative Services and the legislature. And this bill proposes to place the setting of our fees into the administrative rulemaking process. This process legally requires the board to consider public input before the setting of any rule, including those governing our fees. In addition, prior to any fee increase in rule being passed, the board must request and receive the approval of the director of the Department of Administrative Services. And further control is present by the fact that you, by law, the members of the Legislative Assembly, review and ratify any fee increase or establishment. And the Ways and Means process, again, gives you continued oversight. We presented in the Senate two options, basically. We wanted to submit two bills on this issue. One was to merely increase the statutory limitation that we have currently, and the second was to remove our fees from statute. The bill of choice for us was to remove it from statute. And as I presented to the Senate committee, we are willing to accept an increase in our statutory limitation, if that is what you see fit. We are seeking merely to address our financial situation. This bill passed the Senate Revenue Committee unanimously and passed the floor, as you've heard, 27-1. We request you, in addition, to pass it. I would like to just make a brief mention in addition. We are interested in knowing more of what causes the Honorable Representative Butler to bring his concerns against this board. We have made serious strides with this board and in increasing our effectiveness and our efficiency in protecting consumers. And as I'm going to testify in 301, there are some serious issues which we are seeing out there that needs to be addressed. I cannot answer to the past. I have been on this board since June of 1999. I came on at the very tail end of last legislative session. But I can assure you that we at present are a viable agency, and we are doing the job which we are mandated to do. I have 12 years in the state government, and most of it is before you folks in the Legislative Assembly. And I think that you can speak with members of the legislative revenue staff who have been around for some time, the legislative fiscal staff, I should say. They will tell you that I have a reputation for excellence and integrity in government. IRS and Department of Revenue, they do take action on people. However, they are looking to us for an example, and in fact, at this time, the Internal Revenue Service is considering a national registry of tax practitioners. Other states, we've heard from many other states that are interested in enacting a law such as ours because of the gravity of the white-collar crime and fraud in connection with tax preparation that they are seeing. And in fact, we've worked with many states. I can tell you one case in particular where I've gotten calls from three or four states on that very same person who is operating in Oregon. While the revenue agencies seek to correct this, to collect the correct amount of tax, we have the opportunity to proactively address some of the situations, such as the tax protesters, and it saves money in the tail end in the audit, and it helps the general fund by making sure that that is the correct amount of tax collected. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you can help clarify a couple points for me from your testimony. First, you made the point that Senate Bill 279 is critical to the effectiveness of the board, and that's for, presumably, for financial reasons, to have sufficient funds to operate. Yet, it seems to me that if you need additional dollars, you can come to the legislature at any time and propose those dollars. And your testimony seems to indicate that you've had some problems in the previous year or 2 years in terms of maintaining a positive fund balance. Have you come to the legislature and asked for an increase in your fees to address the financial problems that the board has encountered?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, that would be, we could come to the e-board for certain actions. However, it would not be substantive changes such as the fee increase.
Excuse me, I'm not talking about the e-board. I'm talking about the legislature's meeting now. You have a budget proposal. Why can't you come to the legislature now and ask for the fees that you need to operate effectively?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, that's what we're doing at this time. And we did make it clear that we were requesting this to the Ways and Means Committee, and they did that, and we did also tell the Senate committee we were told by DAS that we could only submit one of the two bills that we wanted to submit. We submitted the one of our choice, which was to remove the fees from statute. And when I testified to the Senate committee, I told them that if they wanted to merely increase our statutory level, we would be willing to accept that. We want merely to handle our financial situation.
So just a point of clarification. Then, in other words, what you're saying is that you can get the relief you want from the legislature in terms of allowing you some an increased fee assessment for those practitioners who would be subject to your fees without going to the extent of Senate Bill 279, which eliminates, which allows you to set your fees by rule. That's not necessary to solve your problem. It seems to me what is necessary is for you to make the case to the legislature what additional fees you need and get legislative, get statutory law that specifically provides for that. Isn't that correct?
And that we, I guess that would be the alternative whereby then we would be addressing these dollar amounts in the existing law, and that'd be your plan B, is that it?
Chair Shetterly, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I just raise these questions, Mr. Chairman, because Senate Bill 279 doesn't seem to me is critical to the effectiveness of the board. The board is making the argument that they don't have sufficient dollars in their budget to fulfill their mission, but it seems to me there's an alternative here, and that is to look at the fees and determine if there needs to be some adjustment in the fees to meet their specific needs.
It's interesting, and I want to have some conversation with our Ways and Means colleagues on this, because that's precisely what Ways and Means is equipped to do, to look at the efficiency of the fee, and we'll visit with them and find out what their discussion was. But you say Ways and Means, in working the budget, was aware of your proceeding under 279. Is that right?
Chair Shetterly, yes, they are. And the fee increase, which I have indicated to you, which is a $10 increase on the consultant license and a $20 increase on the tax business license, was included in our budget in several different places.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there's one other point in the testimony I'm confused by, and that's where it says, further control is present by the fact that by law, you, the members of the Legislative Assembly, review and ratify any fee increase. But if we passed Senate Bill 279, we would not be approving and ratifying any fee increase.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, you would in the Senate Bill 333 process, which passed last session, any fee increase and establishment needs to come back to the legislature and be ratified by you.
Even when you pass the fee increase in the interim?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, yes, that's correct.
Do the fees go into effect in the interim?
Yes, they do.
I guess if the fees are over-collected, you mentioned, what does Ways and Means do to you then?
Chair Shetterly, they require us to reduce our fees.
Mr. Chair, the difference in terms of Senate Bill 333, which was passed in the 95 legislative session, what that does is it means that the legislature has the authority to review and rescind an increase. So, in other words, it can take place, but the legislature can negate it through its action.
In the meantime, the increase went into effect and people were paying the higher fee.
If so, what this is proposing is an exemption from that statute. So they would be pulled from, so it would not apply to this particular
okay.
board, and so the legislature would still have authority to prevent the fee increase from going through or to require them to rescind it. But under current law, what the board has to do is come before you and ask for a fee increase. So that's the current status now. What they're asking is to have the flexibility to have a fee increase, and then you'd have to take action to block that.
Affirmatively.
Yes.
Okay. Let me pick up with Representative Hass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're just saying you need some flexibility here. Is that the underlying goal here?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Hass, yes, that's correct. In particular, as in this last biennium, the revenues were over-projected and the imbalance was not present, and that happened before my time. I can't explain how that occurred. However, it put us in the position that we had to stop many programs which we felt were critical to our effectiveness in order to just continue operating.
Just one follow-up for that. Representative Butler mentioned something about the licensure issue, and he didn't think maybe we need to license it. That's irrelevant. That's not dealt with here, is it? And I disagree with him on that, but we're not talking about changing the way we license tax preparers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, no, there is no change to the license statute as a result of this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Yes, to follow up on Representative Haas's statement, first is that this bill strictly states how you're going to adjust your fees, basically. When you can do it by direct with the legislature, or you can do it in a later time be reviewed. My question may not be to you. I've sat on Ways and Means and had multiple boards come in front of us who do not have that option. They have to set their budget for 2 years, set their fees for 2 years, and then we review them at the end of that two-year period in Ways and Means. Why are some boards able to do this and some are not? What's the overall policy here? What are we trying to get to?
Mm-hmm. I don't think I can answer it. I can just say that is the policy question for you. The 95 legislation was a significant piece of legislation, and it marked a major policy change with what had taken place in the past when there was a great deal more flexibility and there was concern there was too much. So when that went into place, we have seen some over the last couple of sessions, we've seen some exceptions created. I mentioned the Board of Accountancy, for example. So there has been some exceptions created. So the issue is, my interpretation of where we are now is still in the transition phase from 95 legislation. How strict do you want to adopt that policy of requiring all fee increases to go through the legislature beforehand, or how much flexibility do you want to give to these boards, particularly in the interim, to deal with financial issues? So that's really the policy issue before you, and to set the criteria that you think is most appropriate for that decision.
I understand. Thank you. Thank you for the explanation.
Who's your LFO policy analyst?
Chair Shetterly, it's John Fletcher at this time.
Joan, would you see if Mr. Fletcher might be available? We're dealing with Ways and Means issues here. Ways and Means analyst, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me how many different states in the United States currently license tax examiners and have a comparable agency like the Oregon Board of Tax Service Examiners?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, there is only the state of California which has a version of our licensing law at this time. However, we have been contacted by numerous agencies within the last few months who are looking at establishing some sort of licensing law. In addition, I have spoken to the Internal Revenue Service Citizens Advocacy Panel, And they view our law as exemplary, and they are looking at some way to, or at possibly, establishing a national registry of tax practitioners, and they're looking to our law for a sort of basis. At this time, they are doing some research as to the benefit of Oregon's law, and so far, that is in favor of what we're doing here.
Is the answer one?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, yes, one.
Representative Bates, yes, one?
No.
Okay. All right, Mr. Zielinski, unless there was anything else over here.
My name is Gerald Zielinski. I'm a current member of the Board of Tax Service Examiners. I'm also one of those people that was grandfathered into the law, one of the few that are left. At the time I was grandfathered into the law, I was a tax preparer, which is the first entry level under the board. You learn and prepare under a licensed tax consultant for 2 years before you are eligible to become a licensed tax consultant if you can pass the test. I did, in fact, in 1980 pass the test and have been a licensed tax consultant since that time. I thought maybe you might be interested in a little bit of history on this board, how it started. It was brought about by the actions of the IRS to start with. They came through with about 10 different agents and went to different offices with a set of plans, in other words, a script that they read on trying to get a tax return prepared. I happened to be with a firm that had six offices. Each office had one of those people come in, but one of the offices had two people come in, and one of the ladies thought it was very odd that there was two people coming in with the same information. So we got all the tax returns together and looked them over. There was like four of them that were fairly close, two of them were out of line, and the basic problem was that the individuals giving the information couldn't give the same information twice or correctly off of the letter. One of the things was that they had a little baby that was born in the year, but the baby was born in the current year, not in the tax year. They didn't, the representatives did not ask these people whether that was which year the child was born, but obviously if you got a child that's born late in the year or early in the year, they're going to come in and say, I got cheated or I've got a new dependent. And it isn't something that we totally have to ask them. We know when they've done something like that. Anyway, as a result, the people that were involved in the returns being done got together and went to Ogden and talked to the people in Ogden about the way they were conducting their interviews, and they found out that in the state of Oregon, there was like 400 and some tax returns that they had prepared, and out of that, there were about 25% of those that were prepared incorrectly, but basically in the way the people asked the questions to the people that were giving us the information to put in the return. So as a result, we came back and put the law together. We have information from the IRS at different times that they came through here into the offices and asked them what they were doing out here. They weren't doing any audits. Well, that's because we put the education law into this, and most of the tax returns that are prepared in Oregon are quite well done because we put in plenty of education into it, and the IRS fully recognizes that. In fact, I was at a meeting in Ogden last fall, and they basically told us that, too. So that's about what I have to say.
Mr. Zielinski, I guess maybe I'll ask you, would you say that the support for the board is fairly high among tax examiners? Maybe tax
yes.
consultants?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Let's bring up Jason Williams.
For the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. It's good to be here, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. We got interested in this issue because we believe in no taxation without representation. And I repeat, no taxation without representation. It's one of those age-old American ethics that really has been a saving grace for how we do taxes since the founding of this country. We believe that the responsibility of raising taxes and fees should be exclusive to this body, to the people's legislature, and not handed out to dozens of government entities that are not elected by the people. We believe that it's better policy
those people that raise taxes be elected by the people. And right now, fee increases are becoming a bigger part of the budget. This year, you know, I've counted 25 fee increases in the governor's budget. It's like a big wave of fee increases coming by. We're also seeing it play a bigger role in its growth in the budget. Knowing that, that we see this big wave of fee increases, it looks bad if the legislature is constantly taking these fee things and doling them out to another entity and having them increase it by people who are not elected by the people. And we feel like with all these fee increases, we feel like some are merited, some are not, and the best way to find out which ones are or are not is by the people most closely related to the people, and that is the representatives. And when I talked to the tax preparers about this measure, they have I have gotten different testimony on whether they feel like there should be a tax examining board, but all of the ones that I've talked to have shown that they don't agree with this unlimited fee request authority. And there will be some people who will probably be sending you some letters in regards to that. I also fail to see that there's no sense of an emergency with this. As the word was used, critical, in the support of this bill, we feel that the idea that if you're going to raise fees and give those people permanent fee-raising authority, that there may be some emergency, but I don't see any emergency or some unusual wild fluctuations in the clients that they serve or something that merits not being able to wait like other agencies every 2 years to come before the board. And I know that, you know, it's been said, well, they go through a public input hearings process, and I spent a little bit of time in my testimony talking about that on the written testimony, because that was something that the Senate Revenue Committee seemed to feel very comfortable if they could just give this fee authority away. Well, at least they have a public input hearing. And for me, I have to voice my opposition to that because taxpayers already have to go to or prompted to go to hundreds of town hall meetings, whether it's a watershed board or a water board meeting or an urban renewal or transportation or zoning or school-related meetings. Now they're being asked to go halfway across the state to attend meetings to defend their wallet. And I feel like a good taxpayer policy would be to say, to draw the line at taxes and fees in terms of being able to take that from the people. And so the whole idea of having a public hearings and public input should not replace actual public representation. And the ratification argument, I don't like that. I don't like the idea that some non-elected government agency could raise fees and then 2 years later then come back and say, well, we spent it, and then the legislature is on the defensive. But that's that is kind of what we feel like. If we want to be able to keep the taxpayer public happy and confident that their vote matters and confident that the fee increases that they're seeing are done in a very sane and a very polished and representative form, that the best way is through that representatives. And that is my testimony.
All right. Questions for Mr. Williams? All right. Thank you very much. Not you. You're a representative. Dallas, are you briefed on this yet? You're smiling. Can't tell what that means. We'll just hold on for a second here.
Getting the game plan together?
Yeah. No, we're not recessing. We're just... You want us to recess?
You could put us at ease.
Yeah, I mean, we're about to find out. Okay. Well, I tell you what. Let's recess the hearing on 279. And while that's happening, since this is another examiner's board bill, let's go into hearing on 301, Senate Bill 301. I'll open that and invite back up Ms. Constantopoulos and Mr. Zielinski and Mr. Martin. If you could take your shot at this one. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Paul, would you give us a background on this then?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 301. as amended, it came from the Senate. What it does is expands the regulatory authority of the board, and it changes the name to the State Board of Tax Practitioners, and it does increase the maximum civil penalty for violations. There was a fair amount of debate in the Senate over what that penalty should be, but there wasn't an increase that was proposed and put into a 301A. The key issue is in terms of expanding regulatory authorities for investigations that the board can talk about in terms of pursuing people that they found in violation. There was a good deal of discussion about adequate resources for the board, and the Senate expressed concern about the board having adequate resources to conduct these investigations. The one issue that came up in terms of the amendments was confidentiality, and that was the amendment that was put into the bill, and whether those that were under investigation would have confidentiality, their confidentiality protected during the investigative phase. And basically what the amendment does is give the board the discretion on that, whether to make that decision, whether to make that available to the public during the investigative process.
All right, we'll begin testimony here until we get our LFO analyst, and then we'll go back and pick up 279. But I thought while we were on the subject, Ms. Constantopoulos, if you want to go ahead and give us the lowdown on this from the board.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, once again, my name is Pamela Constantopoulos. I'm the director of the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners. Any person in the state of Oregon who prepares, assists, or advises in the preparation of personal income tax returns for another and for a fee must be licensed by our board, with a couple of exceptions, such as the certified public accountants and the public accountants. And I would ask you today, if someone stopped you on the steps of the Capitol and asked for your Social Security number and the entirety of your financial information, would you hand it over to that person? Essentially, this is what happens when a client goes into a tax practitioner's office. They hand over all of that information to someone which they have no way of knowing that person is competent and or ethical, with the exception of the fact that that person is licensed. And that is one of the very important reasons why this law is in existence and should stay in existence. The State Board of Tax Service Examiners urges you to pass Senate Bill 301, and the bill seeks to strengthen the consumer protections that we provide by offering more effective and economical compliance enforcement. It also furthers the protections by more clearly identifying the board as the Board of Tax Practitioners. The bill has no fiscal impact, and it requires no additional FTE. Each year, the board sees serious violations that require swift action during tax season to curtail serious harm to Oregon consumers. This concept would provide the board with the following. First, it would give us the authority to issue a cease and desist order when a person or business is engaged in tax activity when not properly licensed. And what we find is almost all of the cases of fraud, deception, and dishonesty occur when a person is not licensed or when the person's license is lapsed. And I use, for example, a person last session whose license lapsed, and she harmed at least 90 consumers by taking money up front for the purpose of doing tax returns and failing to ever provide any tax return to those people. There were serious damages to consumers, and it's that sort of situation that we want to act swiftly and effectively on. At present, it takes several months and a considerable expense to get the equivalent of the cease and desist order in the court. The tax business, of course, the delay means usually that a person has made it through another tax season. And in serious fraud cases, a disreputable person has the ability to harm a large number of people in a short period of time. The bill also provides the legal process that would follow the issuance of that order. This authority would only extend to unlicensed activity, As written, it would not extend this power to duly licensed persons or persons that are exempted, such as the CPAs and the PAs. We also see some serious cases, and I'll give you a couple of examples just so that you understand what we're up against. For instance, we had a person who took $76,000 from an elderly person for the purpose of preparing taxes. This was couched in some other fees, but it was for preparing taxes. And this is the sort of thing that we can act on. We've also got a recent complaint where someone has paid $44,000 to someone over the course of 7 years for preparing taxes. And a taxpayer came to the startling realization just recently that during that seven-year period, there hasn't been a single return filed. Well, that person is out all of that money, in addition to owing fines and penalties with the Internal Revenue Service and the Department of Revenue. We also have Hispanic clients. We recently took joint action with the Department of Justice on a person who was engaged in immigration fraud as well as tax preparation fraud. And the Hispanic community is particularly vulnerable in that many of them do not realize that the government actually can give you money back here. And so it provides an opportunity for stealing the refunds and also manipulating even the figures so that a fraudulent tax return is filed in the name of the taxpayer themselves. And the taxpayer basically is unknowing of that situation. We also request the ability to provide restitution to a consumer harmed. For instance, in the case where the person paid $44,000, at this time we cannot demand any restitution. That has to go through this court system. Or the person that harmed the 90 clients last tax season, those people were out the money. And many of them do not have the means or the knowledge to go through the court system in order to regain those funds. Some of them are of lower income, and the impact of a $170 tax preparation that they now have to pay for again hurts them very hard. In addition, we request the ability to assess the cost of disciplinary actions and other legal actions against the person who's found guilty of violating tax board laws. At the present time, the good standing licensees pay for approximately 89% of all of the violations that occur. It does not seem fair that someone who is maintaining their ethical standards is made to bear the cost of the violations of someone else. So we would like to, in essence, restructure some of the funding to ensure that more of those costs are borne by the people who are in violation. And we've also requested a greater deterrent by increasing the amount of civil penalties from $1,000 to $5,000. We have, for instance, a case where a tax protester was selling some legal jargon that said that you are no longer a state of the United or a citizen of the United States, you are a citizen of the state in which you reside. Therefore, you don't have to pay taxes. And I know how to get you to the zero tax return. He sold those services for $3,500. The civil penalty of $1,000 is merely a cost of doing business to some of those people. And so we wanted to have a larger deterrent by increasing that to $5,000. This, in addition, would bring it into line with some other boards, such as the Board of Accountancy. We also have the ability to keep investigations private when necessary. At some times, of course, as many of you know, you may get a disgruntled client that just wants to smear your name, and it is not necessarily a viable complaint. We would like the opportunity to investigate that and then make the decision whether we can release it or not. And we can release it as it's written. We would be able to release it as necessary to pursue the complaint in investigation and for prosecution. It would also protect the consumer in that after a final decision, any of their financial information that was provided to us in the course of an investigation would remain private. We are also seeking clarification of our authority to refuse a license when a person has been operating illegally or when there is a pending disciplinary action. We're looking for a strengthening of certain administrative rules by placing them into law, such as the ownership of client records, and placing as a prohibited act engaging in dishonesty, fraud, and deception relating to the preparation of personal income tax returns, and also violating a position of trust. Many of these clients do trust definitely their tax practitioner. And finally, it would change the name of the Board of Tax Service Examiners to the Board of Tax Practitioners. We feel that this would more clearly indicate to the public what it is we do. This bill passed out of the Senate Revenue Committee with unanimous support, and it also passed the floor of the Senate with unanimous approval. The Board of Tax Service Examiners requests you to pass Senate Bill 301.
Okay, let me recess this hearing briefly and ask you to step down. We've got our Ways and Means analyst here, and let's ask some questions back on 279. Welcome to the Revenue Subcommittee of Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
I'm John Fletcher, Legislative Fiscal Office, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
You didn't come with prepared testimony. Mr. Fletcher, we have before us Senate Bill 279. Are you familiar with it?
Yes, I am.
I guess we'd like you to help us, if you could, better understand the intersection of this bill with the Ways and Means process, and also some explanation, I guess, about where we are with agencies in terms of fees that are specifically delineated in statute and fees that are agencies, boards, and commissions that have authority to establish fees by rule, and then the Senate Bill 333 process. If you could talk generally about some of that, but start, I guess, with how 279 fits with Ways and Means, where we are with the budget down there, and how.
Okay. Today, the fees for this agency are set in statute. The bill proposes that they would be able to make increases in fees by rule. The governor's budget that was proposed had a policy package in it that included fee increases and assumed passage of the bill. In essence, the governor supported passage of a bill that would allow them to raise their fees by rule. The Ways and Means Committee concurred in the passage of that, and that's where we stand.
Let me get that clear. The Ways and Means assumed the passage of Senate Bill 279?
Well, they passed the package, which included the increased fee revenue. Now, if that revenue isn't realized, then they wouldn't really realize that revenue from this bill. But they're going ahead in support of the funding as if it had materialized, and that's where it stands currently.
And we could do that either by adopting or approving this bill as it is and giving them rule authority, or simply by making the changes in the dollar amounts that are in statute to accommodate that anticipated fee increase?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And either way would provide the revenue. And there are different implications in the future, but that, I think, would accomplish what is needed for the budget either way.
We're going to talk about Senate Bill 333 and the process there. I think that was that the right number? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us how that works with this, assuming that we've passed 279, then what happens?
It's not possible for them to just raise fees to any level. They'll need to come back and have those fees ratified by the legislature in the next session if there is a fee increase that they choose to implement.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
One of your other questions you asked, maybe Fiscal can
give us a little philosophical perspective on when it's appropriate for agencies to have discretion and when not. We've essentially had this mm-hmm. issue on this timber. Well, that wasn't a revenue committee bill. It was another. We had it on the floor today. I don't think that wasn't a revenue committee bill. It was a general government bill about Department of Forestry fee for assessing landowners for suppressing fire. And this issue came up, and when is it appropriate for agencies to have discretion, when not, and is it just a strict case-by-case basis? Someone said earlier the accountancy board has full discretion. Why would they have discretion? The board of tax examiners not? Maybe you can give us some perspective on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, it's a good question. I think it is a case-by-case basis as far as the best way to answer that question. There's, I guess, a policy question on how much oversight is needed by the legislature in some of these areas. If you feel that an agency is operating well in serving the public interest and is regulating things well and administering things well, and actually the members that they serve and the fees paid by those members are reasonable and they are conducting their business efficiently and effectively for the public, perhaps then a conclusion could be more easily drawn that they are capable of reviewing what is needed and carrying forward. On the other hand, if you run into a situation where an agency perhaps has had a change of administration or they're new in terms of the regulatory functions that they provide and or perhaps there are controversial issues or there's been some public outcry or public concern about the way things have been administered. In those cases, perhaps a more close look and a more strict accountability could be easily supported and maybe there'd be a greater basis for doing that. But I think there hasn't been real clean-cut rules as to when someone would be required to have their fee in statute as opposed to having the authority themselves to raise fees by rule. And it's more of what does the legislature feel is required as far as oversight, how much authority should they have, and how well have they done in the past. I don't think that the trend has been to have more and more legislative oversight in some of these areas. I think there's been more the opposite, where we'd like to see a lot of these areas become more self-sufficient and conduct themselves in an efficient way where we don't have to spend the time regulating as we do with some of the greater, larger budgets. At the same time, that's a policy question that the legislature is going to have to decide.
And let me ask you, I guess, in terms of that felt need for legislative oversight, we've got this five-point budget note. What is that, and again, we're the Revenue Committee, we're not the Ways and Means Committee. What does that reflect in terms of Ways and Means attitude toward the board and the level of concern? How common would budget notes of this type be on a budget?
Mr. Chair, the budget note that was attached on this budget is a budget note that goes beyond what would be the norm, I would think, for the health-related licensing boards or other small boards of this nature. And it was specifically included in this case because of a concern of one of the members about the overall mission of this agency.
Would that be Representative Butler?
That would be Representative Butler, who had concerns about whether or not the role the agency's performing here is redundant with some of the federal regulations in place. And
well, we've heard that testimony.
Okay, and consequently, the budget note is an attempt to have them demonstrate the added value that they would provide in that regard. But I would think this indicates concern. At the same time, though, I could point out that the subcommittee did recommend approval of the one policy package that did include the fee increase, and they were in favor of that direction as well. So I think they're trying to address through the budget note one of the members' concerns. At the same time, there was a recognition that they do have a revenue situation that needs to be addressed.
I'd just like to point out, what I said earlier in my question, that last question, but this session then, the Senate members of the subcommittee obviously felt comfortable enough to pass the bill unless the one, if there's one dissenting vote.
It's under a year. Okay. Well, that's very helpful testimony. Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, I will close then public hearing on Senate Bill 279 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 301 and invite back our panel to finish their testimony. And while you're coming, Ms. Constantopoulos, you've got a process in the bill for a hearing. I'm looking on page 4. Beginning on line 5, if a timely demand for hearing is filed, the board shall hold the contested case hearing. The Board of Tax Services, well, whatever you're called now, the Board of Tax Service Examiners, here we go, is under the central panel, isn't it?
Chair Shetterly, yes, they are. And we are.
I don't know, does this language need to reflect that, or would this exempt you where it says that the board shall conduct the hearing?
Chair Shetterly, with your permission, I would like to defer to our Assistant Attorney General, Kyle Martin, which would be best versed to answer that question.
Martin.
Thank you. Chair Shetterly, could you point out again exactly where you're...
Yeah, it's page 4, line 5.
Where in...
If timely demand for a hearing is filed, this is on a notice... that the board shall hold a contested case hearing. That refers to 183.310.550. I'm not sure if that's the central panel.
Chair Shetterly, that is the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay, right.
So it would go within the central panel.
Okay.
If that's your question, yes.
Okay. So the central panel is incorporated in those is in that section of the statutes.
Chair Shetterly, yes, that's my understanding.
Okay. Did you have any other prepared testimony?
Yes, thank you. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, the board, first of all, let me state my name. I'm Kyle Martin. I'm the Assistant Attorney General that acts as lead counsel to the Board of Tax Service Examiners. And the board had asked me to appear today to testify and indicate my support for Senate Bill 301 in regards to expanding the board's enforcement capabilities. There were three points that I wanted to briefly address for the committee. The first one is the board seeks the authority for a cease and desist order, and I wanted to indicate to the committee that this is not unusual authority to request. There are several agencies that already have this authority. For example, there is the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities in ORS 59.245, subsection 4. The Insurance Division in ORS 731.252, the Real Estate in ORS 100.905, and there are others as well. And I think it is important that the board be given this authority because most of the activities for tax practitioners occurs within a short time period. And right now, the board's only method to effectively stop someone is to seek an injunction through the court process. As the director mentioned, the board actually went and did that within the past year, and it proved to be an expensive process. And giving the board the cease and desist order authority would allow them an additional enforcement mechanism that would not be as expensive, yet should have the same impact. There were two other points that I wanted to briefly comment on. The second is the authority to allow the board to seek restitution I think this is an important authority to allow the board. For one, many people do not pay a lot from the standpoint there's not thousands of dollars involved with hiring a tax practitioner. And so allowing the board to seek restitution on behalf of consumers will enable the board to assist those consumers that haven't expended enough or lost enough to require them or to warrant hiring an attorney. And therefore, it will also be a method that the board can use to encourage people to cooperate with the board. In other words, right now, if a person asks, what are you going to be able to do for me, board, the answer is essentially the board doesn't have the authority to go out and seek to help them get their money back or to address that loss. And the restitution provision would allow that to occur. The final point I'd like to bring out is the civil penalty increase. The amount requested, which is $5,000, is, in my opinion, extremely reasonable. It gives the board the flexibility to address situations where there is simply one or two violations that cause great harm to someone. And so it makes it not a cost of doing business, in other words. And this authority, to give examples, there are other agencies that have equal or higher authority. One I'll refer to again is the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. They have a $20,000 maximum per violation. That's in ORS 59.995, subparagraph 1. The Insurance Division is another in ORS 731.988, paragraph 1. They have a $10,000 maximum. And then the Board of Accountancy in ORS 673.400, subparagraph 1, they have a $5,000 maximum. So I would just like to close and say that I would support Senate Bill 301 and urge you to allow the board to have these expanded enforcement tools to better be able to fulfill their mission. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Martin? Representative Bates.
Just kind of walk me through an individual does something you think is inappropriate. You give them a cease and desist order. You have a panel they go to discuss it. Let's say the panel settles against them. Do they have a right to go to court at that point?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Bates, I'm not sure I'm quite understanding. You are
an example of how the system works, what it's being proposed. Let's say an examiner gets in trouble and you have a complaint, you investigate the complaint, you feel they're doing something inappropriate and give them a cease and desist order. They then have a chance to take that to a board, your board. If they disagree with your board, where can they take it next?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Bates, the next step would be for them to appeal to the Court of Appeals. It would be handled through the administrative process. I would like to point out, though, that the cease and desist authority is only as to your unlicensed individuals. It's not as to licensees. And I think the reason that the board is seeking it only as to unlicensed individuals is because in the board's experience, that's where they've seen a lot of fraud and actions of people that essentially are not stopping their activity when they're apprised that they're doing something that is in violation of the law.
Follow up?
Yes.
So let's take it with a licensed individual who's doing the same thing and you can't give them a cease and desist now?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Bates, no, this amendment would not provide for that. The board would need to go through the traditional administrative process, which is to issue a notice against that licensee and then go through the administrative process. Which would consist of, I'm sorry, Chair Shetterly, Representative Bates, it would consist of a hearing before the central panel, which would be a recommended decision to the board, and then once the board has made a final decision, the appeal process would be to the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
I fail to see the logic of allowing one group to do something that you give a cease and desist order for versus another group to give a cease and desist order for if we're trying to protect the public. And you're treating these people in different ways as different classes of criminals, I guess, or whatever you want to look at it. I mean, we're trying to protect the public here. I don't particularly care if it's from a licensed or unlicensed individual. both should have the same type of penalties and jurisdiction over them, I would think.
Chair Shelley, Representative Bates, I think that's more of a policy decision, and maybe the director could address that.
Well, and I think part of it, too, is you're dealing with ones that one has a license, one doesn't. I think the policy under the APA is that a substantially greater due process attaches to something like a license, and you've got that license before it can be summarily yanked or your practice shut down summarily by a cease and desist, than it would for somebody who doesn't have that license in the first place and isn't a participant in the regulated system. I'm guessing.
Chair Shatterly, Representative Bates, we decided to move forward merely because with having it on non-license because that's where we're finding that the gravest violations are occurring. We find that the people who are licensed have something to lose. And we can always revoke a license, suspend the license, and take some serious action in that way. And almost all of the violations that are occurring with the licensed population are cleared up very quickly, voluntarily, by the licensee themselves because they want to maintain that license. But this was specifically addressing the fraud and dishonesty and theft that we're seeing. If it is your decision that we should have that on everyone, I'm sure that the board would not be opposed to that.
That's a good point, because you can suspend a license. So when you have someone who doesn't have a license, you can't suspend that license. The only thing you can do is cease and desist.
My recommendation, you do it the same for both. I mean, you know, if someone's doing, it gives you another piece that you can use if you have to. As you've said, you're in the middle of the tax season. Things are moving fast. You find someone who's licensed or not licensed doing something that you think is really inappropriate, you need to stop that immediately and take care of the licensor situation later. I imagine that's quite a long process to look at someone's license being pulled or not being pulled. Would you agree with that, or would you disagree with me?
Chair Shatterly, Representative Bates, when necessary on a licensee, we can revoke a license very quickly.
Does that stop them from doing what you don't want them? Because then they're unlicensed. You can go ahead and give them a cease and desist at the same time. I suppose that's the avenue, huh?
Mr. Zelensky, you want to chime in on this?
you don't have to.
No, okay. I really don't have anything to say right now.
Representative Butler, you're back in. I'm just about to close the hearing on 301. Did you want to get on record on that?
No.
Okay. All right. In that case, then, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 301. We'll take these up again at a later time. I want to ask a couple questions before we do. And since we've had some very patient folks here listening to this scintillating discussion of our tax examiners' bills, let's reward them for their patience by getting to House Bill 2869. I will open the public hearing on that. Oh, is he here?
Yes.
Where?
It's here. Oh,
Representative Knopf, here you are.
Good.
Elizabeth, we've already had the introduction to this. I would just go ahead and invite Representative Knopf to tell us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Tim Knopf, District 54, which includes Bend, Sun River, and Lapine. And this road district, Special Road District 1, is between Sun River and Lapine, essentially. And my constituent, Bill, it's Gaetano, right? Is here with me today. I want to make sure I get his name right. Is here to speak about the bill, and I wanted to introduce him. This is a long drawn-out problem that the district has had. Several people have been able to get out of the road district, but there's over time things have happened that have indicated that we're going to need a legislative fix to the problem that they have. So I'd like to introduce him, and I do need to apologize to the committee. I have to get back to my own committee Seems that I have more Democrats in the committee currently than I have Republicans, and we have the Democrat bill up. So I thought maybe I ought to head back over there and make sure it doesn't go to work session prematurely.
There goes that spirit of bipartisanship we have before this morning. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Anybody want to ask him a lot of questions?
Just tie him up a little bit.
Well, it's twice and a half of two.
I think I know which road this is. I have a house in Sun River. So
here's a map. Gotta go.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cano. Mr. Gaetano.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, my name is Bill Gaetano, and I represent the Special Road District number one. I just have a brief testimony here concerning the road district, and maybe familiar with road district policies. But as a road district, we are restricted by state laws and statutes prohibiting our municipality from simply creating a fair and equitable tax structure that specifically addresses our needs. This relates to the reduced both service versus taxation issue, that is, not having the ability to shift from a legal withdrawal option to a two-tier taxation zone, designed particularly for those on paved roads versus those on non-paved roads. Many of you may know that maintenance of county roads, paved roads, is paid for by the county road funds, and road district taxes are used to pay for maintenance of non-county roads within the district. And because of our unique situation, in that we have our own equipment, the county hires us to plow their roads. Unfortunately, in road district number one's original road paving plan, a reduced tax structure for those on paved roads was not developed. If members are dissatisfied with the service versus the taxation element of things, the only legal remedy available by state law at this time is withdrawal. Unless the county is willing to give back the roads once controlled by the road district, withdrawal is the only alternative to correct a questionable service versus taxation issue. And if successful, it will only prove to benefit a few from no longer having to pay the road district taxes if everyone else is carrying the burden. This is self-destructive, causing unnecessary division amongst members and promotes unrevocable lost revenue to road district funds, whereas a two-tier tax structure option at least addresses the road district in total as a contiguous district, the ability to create tax zones based upon services rendered. Now, over a year ago, for the second time, a few members attempted to withdraw, supported by the county commissioners, 2-1. However, a unified road district action group petitioned to put the withdrawal to a special election. The members overwhelmingly defeated all withdrawal attempts, 250-36, and the two county commissioner votes made it 38. Now, this one-and-a-half-year-old ordeal created a great hardship to the community and cost several thousands of dollars to the district, yet the members stood strong. Now, in my opinion, the true essence of the election was not about equitable justice for a few, believing they were not receiving road district services, therefore not liable to pay road district taxes, but about a majority voting to keep the road district together and supporting the fact that withdrawal is not the present or future remedy to solve a service versus taxation issue. It was only a process probing for a better solution. The ideal is to maintain the road district as one. A voice from the past says give the roads back to the road district. The voice of the future says replace the withdrawal option with a tax bill option that differentiates paved roads from the non-paved roads. And to help alleviate future withdrawal attempts, the road district commissioners believe the option of a second-tier tax structure is the better tool over withdrawal and should be granted to our road district members and then allow the members to decide. Again, withdrawal only diminishes, not enhances, the resources of a road district.
Questions?
Do you have a map?
Could you describe? Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Beck. We have, apparently, this is put out by the Deschutes County Road Department. If you're familiar with Sun River, this is the Deschutes River right in here, and then through. This is the road to Mount Bachelor, and over on this side here is Sun River proper. So this is a subdivision right in here, which was developed about back in the 1960s. Quite frankly, half the properties in here will not pass for septic.
Right.
And it's very, very unfortunate for people. This is another issue that are paying road district taxes and county taxes to not improve on their property. I'm in real estate, so I talk to these people all the time. And essentially, apparently the county tax assessor has laid out the paved road section right here.